You know, I always tell startup founders that, you know, in real estate, as you are very much aware, it's location, location, location. And in startups, it's team, team, team. So you can have a lousy idea, quite frankly, with an amazing team, and it can be a go, or you can have an amazing idea with a lousy no-name team, and it's a stop, right? So, you know, a team, a smart team, an experienced team in this space can pivot when they need to, when they learn something, they, you know, because business models change, quite frankly, and it's just common in the startup world, right? You go out with a premise, hopefully you do interviews like we did, you measure three times and cut once. That's not always the case, but a smart team will figure that out.
You are listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
So on Hooked on Startups today, I am absolutely delighted to have Laura Wagner with me. Laura, welcome to the show.
Matthew, thanks so much for having me.
Great. And so Laura, you're a serial entrepreneur in the payment space. You're the chief executive officer and the founder of Digits, which has solved a major problem for platforms that need to be able to collect payments through credit cards. I mean, this is an industry, I think, that very few people are aware of, but it's one of these sort of huge foundation blocks of e-commerce. And it's funny because it's something that you would imagine is incredibly modern and right up to speed with all the latest developments. But the opportunity that you found came from discovering that over your sort of 20 plus years in the industry, that it is quite the opposite. Is that a fair sort of assessment?
Yeah, I have been in payments 20 years, and a good friend of mine, Mark Miller, who's the CEO of TicketSocket, called me up about 3 years ago and said, you know, your stuff in payments, why is this so difficult? And I'm like, well, tell me about it. What is it? I actually had no idea of the problem. He enlightened me. You know, his team had to be connected to 20 different payment gateways, and his merchants would be, for example, New York City Marathon. And Mark would go pitch New York City Marathon and say, hey, New York City Marathon, don't build an elaborate website where people can take registrations and buy tickets. We've got that on our, you know, on our platform, and you can have it overnight. And by the way, we typically charge whoever's buying a ticket $2 extra. So it's really free to New York City Marathon. So the guy from New York City Marathon gets excited and says, great, where do I sign? And Mark always had to say, I just need you to go get a merchant account somewhere at Stripe or First Data or wherever, right? The usual suspects. And about half the time, he'd lose that sale to the process of getting a merchant account because it takes 1 to 3 weeks. It, you know, traditionally old school style, takes 1 to 3 weeks. They have to be underwritten. They need to go to three different companies, a payment gateway, a Visa MasterCard shop, and an American Express shop. Stripe made that a lot easier, but he still had to send them to Stripe.com, and they still had to come back and quote unquote connect their merchant account. So it was, you know, either super slow or he still had to send them somewhere else outside of his ecosystem.
So if you take another example, so let's say that there's, you know, there's been an awful lot of sort of tragedy in terms of fires and hurricanes. And let's say that there's a local group wanted to set up outside of the crowdfunding platforms, but wanted to set up a website where people could donate locally, for example. What they would do traditionally is they'd be able to create the site and they'd be able to create some sort of local community action. They would go to a platform and they would say, I need to be able to collect donations. And the platform would say, no problem, go online, fill out a form. You can have the ability instantly. But the problem then is that they would then, the charity or whatever, would then have to go to MasterCard or whoever. And that's where the delay is. Is that, that's
the sort of the three. Great example. So, you know, some platforms like GoFundMe, those poor folks in Vegas, you know, recently you hear that GoFundMe was able to raise, you know, millions of dollars, which is amazing. And when somebody donates to that cause today, they see GoFundMe in their bank statement. So GoFundMe is the single merchant. So that's more of a marketplace. But there are other platforms like Mobile Cause, which is a great one, that they will actually set up a merchant account for American Red Cross, right? So if American Red Cross is, you know, collecting money, the person donating actually sees American Red Cross in their bank statement. You see the difference?
Yes.
And exactly. So that we are the latter. In other words, we really come in when a platform like MobileCause has to set up real-time merchant accounts for the users of their software.
And this is a real problem. So because if I'm the person wanting to sell something through an e-commerce platform, that for me is a major roadblock, because I could have my entire business set up and ready to go with my website and my shopping cart, but then I would have to climb this mountain with these financial monoliths, presumably tons of paperwork going backwards and forwards to get my merchant accounts so that I could collect on a credit card. Exactly. And that's the problem that you solve.
Yeah, we solve it for both sides, right? We solve it for the platform so they don't lose the merchant that's looking to use the platform's software, right? And we also solve problems for the merchant, because now instead of having to go out and go through all those hoops to get a merchant account, and also when they want to see their bank settlements or handle chargebacks, they also have to log into other websites. Now with us, it's all done inside of the ecosystem of the software. They never have to, they get their merchant account from within software, they see their transactions within the software, they handle chargebacks within the software. It's easier for everybody involved.
And that's great. So from a platform's perspective, which is the guy that provides me with the software that I can set up my shop online, that must be great, because how many people basically give up when they suddenly receive their 500-page application form from these card processing companies? So did you find that you're really having your people sort of knocking your door down saying, God, this really unlocks a problem for us, because we're losing so many potential merchants or sort of website owners because they can't get over that last mile problem?
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And yes, I mean, I've personally interviewed in the last couple of years, I'd say close to 300 platform CEOs. I only talk to CEOs, by the way. We're looking for visionary platform CEOs who understand that for them to be successful in their niche, because it's becoming very competitive in each niche, they're going to need to bake payments into their ecosystem and their UI and their UX. Otherwise, they're just a kind of a glorified, you know, connector of merchant accounts, and anybody can leave one ticketing platform and go to another ticketing platform and take their Stripe account with them or take their XYZ merchant account with them. But when you bake it in, they're into your ecosystem. They are locked in. It makes the experience very sticky.
And again, that sort of separates. So what you're doing is you're really, so in terms of where you are, you've got the Visas, the Amexes, the MasterCards at the sort of top, as it were. Then you have at the bottom, you have the payment service providers. So these are the people that provide the shopping carts and the software to enable me to sell my artistically designed socks online. But you sit in the middle, so you sort of act as this big funnel. So all of these payment service providers will want to come through you because you provide them with something that gets their customers to market. So you must have a huge audience of payment service providers.
Yeah, well, that's an actual term in the payment space, so I wouldn't use that term. That's a, you know, the kinds of platforms that we cater to are ticketing platforms that have merchants like, you know, festivals and marathon races, car dealership software used by car dealers, tuition payment platforms used by schools, fine payment platforms used by city governments, and all of those people that are using the software, those are merchants, right? So, you know, the New York City Marathon, the school, et cetera, those are the merchants using the platform. Now, the platforms do 10 things, let's say, but just one of them, one of the 10 happens to be to process a credit card payment or a credit card payment. So, you know, they get sold on all of these cool benefits that these software platforms have. And right when the guy's trying to close them, he goes, oh, by the way, to get the ball going, I just need you to go get a merchant account. So it's like selling somebody on a Maserati. And right before they walk in and you're dangling the keys, you say, hey, could you just jog around the block about 15 times? And then, you know, when you get good and sweaty, maybe I'll think about letting you in the car.
That's, I know. And that must be a real opportunity. So, I mean, what is the size of the market? I mean, so the market that you are now you've now positioned yourself in the epicenter of all of this payment traffic.
Yeah. So when you think about it, back in the day, a school used to set up their own website, right? And it used to be a pretty crappy one. Or the county would set up a website to take payments for their tuition payments. I'm not tuition, fine payments, things like that. So now what most of them are doing is they are going to platforms, and they're instead of developing their own website, they're using the software of the platforms that's sitting in the cloud that they sometimes get for free, right? Yep. And because sometimes the platform charges the person paying, for instance, the property tax, you know, the platform will charge an extra 3% to the person paying their property tax. So it's actually free to the county. Got what I'm saying? So there's very big advantages to using these software platforms. It's quick, it's easy, it can take a day to set them up. They stay very secure. They update themselves. You know, there's just so many benefits. So what's happening is droves of merchants are going away from their own crappy little websites to using these high-tech software cloud-based, I call them shared platforms, right? Because one platform, our average platform processes about $20 million a month between all of their merchants. So we only need five platforms using us that could generate a single $100 million a month of processing. So our customer is not the small merchants. Our customer is the platforms.
Understood, exactly. So, for example, I paid my water bill recently, and as I click the pay by Visa, a window pops up saying, we're now transferring you over to our, you know, XYZ company. They'll take the payment for you, which is great for the water company because then they can take payments online. They haven't got to worry about all that tech and software that's involved and rebuilding their website. And what you do is you say to that company that we can get you to market immediately, but most importantly, you're grabbing a clip of the ticket or a tiny percentage of each transaction as it goes through.
Yeah, and so is the platform, by the way. So, you know, we typically charge, you know, sort of the usual going rate today of 2.9 and 30 cents to the merchants, but out of that, we pay commissions to the platform as well. So the big benefits to the platform are the fact that they can add. So if they want us to charge a merchant 2.9 and 30 and plus 1% for the use of their software, we can charge a merchant 3.9 and 30, split out 1%, give it to the platform every day. And then at the end of the month, we could revenue share on the 2.9/30.
And then if we look at that in the context of the size of the industry, so you know, this is not an industry in the US that is measured in millions of dollars. It's measured in billions or, you know.
It's a trillion. It literally, by 2020, in the US, $8 trillion a year will be processed on Visa, MasterCard, and American Express cards. $8 trillion.
And I think the bulk, again, I don't have the figures to hand, but I would imagine that an enormous percentage of those transactions will be handled through e-commerce platforms or through platforms.
Yeah, $1 trillion, to be exact, is what they're predicting of the eight is going to come through these platforms. So that makes the CEOs of these platforms the new gatekeepers of a $1 trillion market.
So your model really is this, it is this truly sort of scalable. So you are in the sort of gold rush, there's this sort of, you know, the picks and shovels, as it were. So is that a way of describing what Digits does? So you're sort of re-engineering you found the major bottleneck, the pain points of this sector.
And well, you know, it's funny. What comes to my mind, what would we be in a gold rush? I'd love to be the bar. I'd love to own the local saloon. You know, because we say that we make payments painless. So, you know, we could make gold hunting painless with a nice drink at the end of the day.
Or a celebratory drink, exactly, for discovering. So your background then, so this is, and obviously this, the ability to spot what is really a major failing point in a $1 trillion business. So give me a bit of background about how you came across being able to spot that opportunity.
Yeah. So, you know, Mark is the one who enlightened me about it. And I set out on a pretty intense journey with, you know, the first CFO of PayPal, David Jakes, is the chairman of our board. And Linda Perry ran Visa for 17 years. Edward Katzen was head of worldwide payments at Apple. And, you know, we just got up on a whiteboard in San Francisco about 3 years ago and mapped out the problem and mapped out what had to happen on the back end to solve it. And it was pretty, tall order because it requires real-time merchant underwriting and risk taking, right?
Yep.
Instead of underwriting a merchant for 1 to 3 weeks in advance, you have to give them an instant merchant account, which is risky to some degree.
Yep.
So, you know, we count on the platforms to tell us the profile of those things. And it took, you know, quite a while to find the right backend partner, which we finally did. Then it, you know, we went out and interviewed initially 50 CEOs to see if they had the same problems that Mark had. And when they did, we set out to build a very modern payment API that solved just the things that needed to be solved. And then we went live early this year with TicketSocket as our first beta. And they put on their first merchant in February. They're now approaching about 30 merchants that they put on. And we should have a single $1 million month in Q4 this year in processing.
Wow. Okay.
So it's, you know, we make a sliver of that, right? So on $1 million month, we'll charge $3 million to all the merchants using the platform, right? Like 3% on average. And then we get a piece of that and we give the platform a piece of that. And we end up with a little smaller piece, but it's a really nice model.
But again, but the great thing here is the scalability, is this whole concept of build it once and sell it over and over and over again with that, the ability to scale to the nth degree.
Yeah, unlike a lot of technology, businesses are scalable in theory, but the goal to this is that it's a one-to-many process. So getting one platform may take quite a while, right?
Yep.
And it may take quite a while for them to get the ball rolling. But once that ball is rolling, it is on autopilot. And they put their first merchants on, their new merchants, right away. But their old merchants, when they're comfortable, they start to transition over to us. So the goal is to get them, you know, integrated, you know, PCI compliant, and then from there to get their first, you know, merchants, first 7 to 10 merchants on, and then, you know, to not only get their brand new merchants, but also start getting some of their old merchants moved over.
And presumably you're working in, hand in hand with the card processors, with the likes of, you know, the Visa and MasterCard. This is not a disruptive business model. It's more of you're kind of solving a problem that was there that no one knew how to solve. But what you're not doing is taking money away from, you're not biting the hand that feeds you effectively. Yeah.
But Visa and MasterCard and American Express don't sell directly to anybody. They only sell to intermediaries. So they always make their cut, no matter what we do in the middle to solve problems. So it is a disruptive solution for platforms. Visa, MasterCard, American Express, they're always going to get their cut no matter what you do.
And clearly, I think what's happened is that you've solved a problem. And I think it's become pretty clear to, you know, the investing public as a whole so far that what you've got is something that is very valuable, that is very scalable, because you've got a crowdfunding round coming up in a couple of weeks. Is that right? On the October the 18th?
Next week. Yeah. October 18th on Crowdfunder.
Okay. Now, but this is not your first fundraise on Crowdfunder.
It's not my first rodeo. So we love Crowdfunder. For you startup founders out there, I can't give them a big enough endorsement. They're an awesome platform. We launched with them in 2015 and also 2016, and we've had a great run. Last year, we became number one in the U.S. out of the top 50 companies raising from the crowd. And so far, we've raised a little over $6 million. So it's, you know, there's just not a ton of choices out there when it comes to pre-product, pre-revenue startups to get funded. You know, VCs and super angels are moving much later stage typically. And there's just this pretty massive hole between, you know, friends and family and traction.
You're right. And again, I think that those two phrases, pre-product and pre-revenue, the fact that you could raise, you know, $6, $7 million based on the fact that it was a future technology that you were going to roll out is astonishing, because you're absolutely right. I mean, it's. I think the investing public generally are quite discerning, you know, particularly with the crowdfunding platforms from 2015 and 2016, which were only available to accredited investors.
Yeah, all of our investors are accredited.
These are pretty sophisticated people.
Yeah, they are. We love them. I mean, we've got 110 investors and we love every one of them. And I personally spoke with and explained our business to every single one.
But that is a great vote of confidence. And what did you find was the critical thing to get the confidence and to get these people to buy into what you were doing?
Well, I always tell startup founders that, in real estate, as you are very much aware, it's location, location, location. And in startups, it's team, team, team. So you can have a lousy idea, quite frankly, with an amazing team, and it can be a go, or you can have an amazing idea with a lousy no-name team, and it's a stop, right? So, you know, a team, a smart team, an experienced team in this space can pivot when they need to, when they learn something, because business models change, quite frankly, and it's just common in the startup world, right? You go out with a premise, hopefully you do interviews like we did, you measure three times and cut once. That's not always the case, but a smart team will figure that out. But, you know, if it's not a team filled with people that you have tremendous confidence in, it's tough in the startup world.
I agree. I think it's both actually. You've got to have a good idea that's scalable, that's in a marketplace, that it's not a sunset industry. So what do you have?
I think we had both. I think you're right. But I'm making the analogy that I hear a lot of lousy
ideas
with lousy team. And when I say lousy, I mean teams where they don't have subject matter expertise in what they're trying to set up. And they don't have anybody actually saying or testifying that there's a real problem to solve. It's just an idea from a group of people who say, hey, wouldn't this be cool to do? And that's just not enough these days. You have to be solving a huge problem in a huge market with a team that understands how to do it.
Yeah, and I completely agree, because I think the real issue is that so many startups, and this is why 95% of startups, particularly tech startups, fail, in my opinion, is because they have an idea, they may have execution capability, but they don't have, they're not solving a problem. In other words, if you say to them, what is this problem that you're solving? They're creating something that is a nice to have rather than something that has this defined problem. So, how many times have you come across technology where you say, this looks brilliant, but I still can't figure out how it's relevant to me. But what you've done is find that real bottleneck, that real sort of pinch point in a $1 trillion business. And you've found a solution for that. And you've put together a team that has this demonstrable track record in this space. And I think that's what's come out.
We're still in very, very early stages. So we've just got very early stage beginning revenue with one platform. We've got four other signed that are in various stages of integrating and going live. And the goal is for us to identify ourselves in five verticals and then five more, and then go 5 to 10 deep into each. And we do believe that we'll probably be acquired before, somewhere around 2019 to 2021 by a large legacy processor. That's our end game.
Because that would give them a significant market advantage to be able to provide your technology, because then their card, for example, or their business would be have a significant advantage over the competition. So there is a natural buyout path for your business.
Yeah, the top 10 legacy, we call them legacy processors in the US, simply don't have the technology to play in the modern software space. And so this is, and they also don't have direct sales ability. They sell through 1099 agents. Yep. So their deficits are in many areas and huge barriers to do what we're doing for those guys. So it's better for them to buy than build.
It is. And again, as you said, I think the legacy technology issues are insurmountable in many cases, where the idea of trying to change their existing systems to do what you're doing is almost an impossible task. Whereas it's so much easier to, as you say, the opportunity is buy or build. And for them to buy you is makes so much more sense financially and from an execution perspective. So yeah, you are a natural buyout, sort of target.
Yeah. There's no guarantees. That's just what we're going for. Right. And we also have the opportunity to stay the course and keep adding value to the company.
And just going back a bit. So how did you manage to land But what conversations, because one of the key things from a startup company's perspective is trying to get that key team on board. Mm-hmm. And is it, what did you find? What was it that enabled you to bring in the likes of, the chief executive, the chief financial officer of PayPal, or, Kevin Harrington, for example?
Yeah, I can be a little bit like a dog on a pant leg. I'm from Texas. And, you know, when I want something, I get it. And, they would all probably smile if they hear that. But, we have, I just went after them, told them how much I wanted them and needed them to be on board, and didn't quit till they said yes. I mean,
there's a story I picked up somewhere about a voicemail or several voicemails that you left someone in ancient history. Is that sort of related?
That goes back to my first company that was, I was the first credit card processor at McDonald's, ironically, strangely enough. And to get that ball started, I had to call Rose Nash, who was in charge of that at McDonald's, 29 times. And, I used to call at different times of the day and night, which is a strategy, right? Because if you call all the time at 6 p.m., you miss people. You try 6 a.m., 10 a.m., 2 p.m. Finally, 7 o'clock one night, I called her, and I had left a message for her that said, "One way or another, I'm going to find you. I'm going to get you. So and that's another strategy that I used to do in sales.
The Debbie Harry strategy, yes.
Yeah, and when she finally answered the phone, she started laughing because I said, "Aha!" Because it's the first time she actually answered the phone. And so I said, "Don't move. I'm coming down there right now." And I went to her office, and we literally talked until 10 o'clock. So I remember the vacuuming going on by the people in the office building. We ended up being dear friends. But bottom line, she let me into a RFP with a couple of hundred processors were trying to compete to get their business.
Wow.
And we actually won out with our solution.
And so that must have been a real sort of rocket that you'd sort of strapped yourself to, as it were.
Yeah, I'm not sure I felt that way at the time. I was like, "Oh my shit, what?" Yeah, that's right. What have I done?
They say be careful what you wish for.
Yes. But, it was quite a story. And we ended up, the processor that we used ended up getting purchased by First Data, and in all the press releases it talked about the reason they purchased the processor was because of McDonald's, which we brought to the table.
But the real story there is one of just pure dogged determination. It's not that there's a lot of myth out there about startups being in some Olympian detachment where you come up with an idea, you automatically raise $10 million in VC funding. There's no account for the humanity, for the determination, those sleepless nights, there's a big backstory that always accompanies the sort of successes that you have.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, that then the alarm clock goes off, right? You dream about all those things as a startup founder, but that I think the most successful teams have deep experience and knowledge in their space, and they have to have all the right stuff. They have to be solving a big problem. And then there has to be, quite frankly, a rainmaker that,
yep,
is, or the Pied Piper, whatever you want to call it, right? That's out passionately, going after that customer.
And again, that is something that that has to be in you. That's all about, the vision, the passion, the fact that every morning you would get up and come rain, shine, snow, hail, countless no's, countless roadblocks, banana skins, you name it, you're still there. So I think the story there is that this is not just about putting a team together with a few phone calls. It's about that enormous amount of energy and knockbacks that you have to take to get to where you are. So just not to downplay that, that's all.
Yeah, no, the visual is sort of like those blow up dolls that you can punch down, they have to pop back up. You know, when you're an entrepreneur starting your own thing, you cannot afford the luxury of a negative thought. You got to be positive and almost relentlessly positive, because what's the alternative, right?
But the payoff is being able to, play a pivotal role in a trillion-dollar industry. And I guess that's not something that a few years ago, did you see yourself as, as playing such a major role in such a major industry?
I knew that, I'm a serial entrepreneur and this is my third payment company. So I'm really in love with the space. I'm in love with solving problems. And once I was alerted to this problem, it was a challenge because I didn't know it existed and solving it was really challenging. I mean, even with all of our backgrounds and relationships and knowledge of payments, it was incredibly difficult to get airborne and get it solved.
Exactly. And I think a lot of the problems come from funding as well. So you've got a book coming out, which is Crowdability. Is that right?
Yes, Crowdability.
And tell me a little bit about the book and how you sort of explore your formula for success in raising capital through the crowd.
It basically is a labor of love for startup founders to know that the crowd is a truly viable option, but there is a formula, right? Yeah. A formula in a way that you have to go about it. It's not like you put up a profile at Crowdfunder and they will come. That only happens in movies about baseball players, yeah. Right? There's a very strategic formula, and it has to do with launching the profile with traction day one. I mean, beyond the normal startup score, right? Your team, your market size, the problem you're solving, all of those things you see them all over the internet, right? Those are sort of standard things and you have to have a score there. And if your score is low, you're going to have a challenge to begin with.
Yep.
But then, you have to also spend money. You can't go about equity crowdfunding without spending a good amount of money. You have to have really quality videos. You have to have your own website looking really nicely. Your materials have to be up to par. You have to have a really good attorney. Joe Daniels with McCarter English is our attorney. And, he's a very seasoned SEC attorney. So, there's all kinds of things that you have to be prepared. So it takes a good 6 months. It takes a good, 50 to 100K. It takes talent on board to get prepared and all kinds of vendors and social media and outreach. And then you really need to market yourself the day you launch appropriately, there's not to be overwhelmed. You don't want to be overwhelmed with all these things, but you can see a direct correlation between the companies that do these things and the companies that don't. And the ones that do are far and few between.
Yeah. And I think that's, but the payoff really is that, it is challenging. It is difficult to get it right, but there is a formula. And obviously you've figured out what that formula is. And I think that's what you go through. And that's what you explain sort of step by step in your book. So I guess when is the book coming out?
Not yet. We're going to get past this round. We're raising five. we're starting this round. It's a 5 million round on Crowdfunder October 18th. And so we'll get past that and probably some point next year. This is just more of a labor of love for me just to spread the word because it really is a fantastic option.
Well, that is and great. And what it does, I think most importantly, is it enables people other than super high net worth, super rich people or VC firms to actually participate in these really exciting companies that are doing the sort of things that you're doing. So the great thing about Crowdfunder is it's just being able to have a piece of what you're doing without, without having to have my own fund or without having to be worth, the same as a small African state.
Right, right.
But Laura, now is the time that we have my questionnaire. Well, I say it's my questionnaire, but it's something that I borrowed from James Lipton from Inside the Actor Studio. And I'm forever worried that I'm going to get an email from his lawyer. So James Lipton, thank you once again for the use of your questionnaire. But my 10 questions just to round this up are as follows. So the first question is, Laura, what is your favorite word?
Favorite word. I live, eat, and breathe what I'm doing right now. So favorite word for me right now is unicorn.
Fantastic. There we are. The shape of things to come. That's a faint signal from the future, everyone. So therein is the hint. So what is your least favorite word?
Startup, strangely enough, because I think it's overused and underdescribed and underappreciated.
Very, very, very clear. So third question is, what are you most excited about right now?
Can you guess? It's digits.
I can see why. And what turns you off right now?
doubt.
Yeah, okay. What sound or noise do you love?
The ocean.
And what sound or noise do you hate?
Traffic.
I think you're not alone there. What's your favorite curse word?
Oh, man. Well, you know, I'm a Texan, so I can do that from time to time. I think it would have to be the F word by itself or with an ing behind it.
That's fantastic. But again, you know, the most universally loved curse word. So certainly used in the most appropriate circumstances, of course. And what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Oh boy. When I hear attempt, it doesn't resonate. It's that old Star Wars thing. There's no try. There's only do. And I love helping entrepreneurs win. And I'm not sure that that's a profession, but that's a passion.
That's brilliant. And what profession would you not like to attempt?
The short answer is I'm classically unemployable. So I don't think that's an option.
No, I know that feeling. So yeah, anything that involves you being employed is kryptonite. My final question. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Good job down there.
Fantastic. Well, Laura, my final question is, how do people find out more about you, about what you're doing with Digits? How do they get involved with the crowdfunding campaign that's kicking off in 6 days' time? What are the best ways of getting hold of you?
Yeah, it's really simple. Just go to crowdfunder.com/digits with a Z like zebra, S like Sam on the end. So DIGITZS. And pretty much it's all up there for everybody to see. We'd love to have you.
Fabulous. And Laura, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And, you know, I look forward to telling everyone that I knew Laura, who is the CEO of the next unicorn.
You're a doll, Matthew. Thanks for having me.